This is Sustainable East End, a show about land use, energy and water resources, transportation, and the farming and food industries on the eastern end of Long Island. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, co-producer with Tony Ernst. Ticks and the diseases they cause were on the minds of East Enders again this summer, one of the worst tick seasons ever. To find out about ticks, their animal carriers, associated diseases, and how we can protect against them, I spoke with Tamsin Yeh of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Suffolk County in Riverhead. Tamsin Yeh, welcome to Sustainable East End. You're a turf and land management specialist with Cornell Cooperative Extension of Suffolk County, working with a pest management program. What is the connection between what you do and your vast knowledge about ticks?
Well, ticks is one of the things that we scout for on county properties, and we try to make sure that we keep track of them on certain properties. We try to know when they're out and about so that we can report to whatever county workers might be outside and working on those properties. And we also try to provide education for all residents of Suffolk County on ticks and what problems ticks can cause and the best way to deal with them.
Hmm. So now, there are some myths about ticks out there, probably a lot of myths that people have because people are very concerned about it. Which common myths most concern you?
One of the ones that concerns me is that people think they have chiggers. So far, we haven't been able to find true chiggers, which are a life stage of a mite on Long Island, but what we do find is lots and lots of larval Lone Star ticks, which cause tremendous itching, and they tend to bite in mass. And so people are confused about that, and they should know what's biting them, because occasionally when they've been bitten by a lot of larval Lone Star ticks, they might develop the alpha-gal meat allergy, which has been in the news quite a bit. The other major myth that bothers me particularly about ticks is that people don't use necessarily the best repellent for ticks. Many people use repellents that are largely DEET-based. DEET is great for mosquitoes, but for ticks, you might want to switch to the active ingredient, which is displayed on the front of the container of the repellent. The active ingredient's picaridin, or IR3535. That may afford somewhat better protection for people. And if they're curious as to how well their repellent works, they can look up online Rate My Repellent as a search string, and what should come up is an EPA website, which is a searchable database by active ingredient or EPA number, or by the brand name of all of the different mosquito and tick repellents that are out there.
So now, to go back to an earlier point you made, you mentioned the alpha-gal, which is an allergy to meat that people can get from the Lone Star tick. They can get it from larval ticks. You know, now, I never see the larval ticks. I only see the bites. So how long do they actually have to be on you before you get the allergy?
Well, that's the thing. Everybody's immune system is different, and not everybody will get the allergy. The way that this allergy works is that the tick saliva has something called alpha-galactose in it, and so does the mammalian meat that we consume. And the body can't recognize the difference between alpha-galactose and tick saliva and meat. So when you consume meat, certain people consume meat, the body thinks it's being attacked by tick saliva, and you have a reaction to that. That's how alpha-gal works. And everybody's reaction is a little bit different. Some people react very severely, if they develop a reaction at all, and other people, it's much milder. And sometimes people that have this alpha-gal syndrome, if they stop eating meat for a few years, they may be able to go back to it and then not have the problem, provided that they have not been re-exposed to tick saliva.
Huh. In other words, they don't have to be attached to you for a long time like other ticks to transmit disease.
Right, that's right. It's a reaction to the saliva, and usually the saliva of multiple ticks biting you at the same time. It sort of sets off a reaction in your immune system. Of course, your immune system can produce memory cells, and they remember this tick saliva component, but unfortunately, it's similar enough to a component on mammalian meats. Now, you can eat as much chicken and fish as you want, or poultry and fish as you want, because they don't have that alpha-galactose. But mammalian meats, and sometimes even cheese or dairy or gelatin, it's like gel caps on medications, is enough to set very sensitive people off. But again, not everyone develops this. It's only a certain unlucky few, and then even fewer than that develop a very serious reaction.
I see. Okay. Yeah, because I remember having those quote-unquote chiggers, which actually when I went to the doctor, that's what they told me. They were like, oh, those are chiggers. And I thought to myself, you know, I don't know if they're chiggers because they don't really act like chiggers.
Right. And yeah, chiggers are quite a bit different in their behavior and in their feeding. A tick, even a larval tick, takes a blood meal. But a true chigger does not. They feed on the cellular contents, and what they do is they spit out enzyme, which basically will digest a little hole in the skin so that the chigger can get into the fluids in your cells. But they expose, through this enzymatic action, proteins that are actually your own, but they're usually masked by other proteins, and suddenly your body does not recognize the proteins that were previously masked, and that's why you would have a reaction to a chigger bite. So a chigger is not even a blood feeder. But sometimes what happens is if you don't see ticks all the time, you can have something misidentified, say people calling it chiggers when it's actually ticks. So you can always double check with cooperative extension, especially if you have the larger ticks. We can pop them under the microscope, even if you have the larval ones, and tell you what they are.
Yeah, and now I was just out today and I noticed when I came in, I was wearing shorts, and unlike my usual want, I had not put, now I usually do use DEET, and now I know to use something that has picaridin in it, but I always do wear boots that have permethrin.
Yeah, yes. That you can readily buy at any sporting goods store, but permethrin should never go directly on your skin. It's a pesticide, not a repellent. Mm-hmm. So while it can go on your gear and on your clothing, you should allow it to thoroughly dry on your gear or on your clothing or shoes, but never apply it directly to your skin.
Right. So, but I noticed when I came in that I had a couple of bites. They look like mosquito bites, and I went into the shower and I scrubbed them. I didn't put a microscope on the bites and I didn't see anything. So how can one know if one has had larval ticks on one, especially if you don't have a lot?
Right. Usually, like you say, you're looking for them in mass because they, for the Lone Stars, they do tend to cluster together and bite all in the same area. If you just get one or two on you and you do scrub yourself down, it's going to be very difficult to tell whether you have a mosquito bite or a tick bite. The only thing is that the tick bites tend to itch longer than the mosquito bites. The mosquito bite itch will usually go away in a few days, but a tick bite will usually itch you for maybe 2 or 3 weeks.
Right.
And it's very important not to scratch any bite because we have loads of bacteria under our fingernails and you can get a really bad infection that way.
So talk about the different kinds of ticks. Lone Star do seem to be pretty dominant, at least where I live. I live in the middle of the woods.
They are the most prevalent tick on Long Island, the Lone Star ticks. The other two types of ticks we have are the black-legged or deer ticks, which everybody knows are the ones that carry Lyme disease, and dog ticks, which should never be ignored either because they can carry Rocky Mountain spotted fever. There is a great deal of behavioral differences between the ticks. For example, the deer population really drives the Lone Star tick population, whereas rodent populations are more likely to drive the deer tick populations. Also, the Lone Star ticks will wander. They will actually follow you, and they will go out into hot, dry areas, whereas the deer ticks will not. They will stick to about a 6-foot radius or less of where they actually hatched out of the leaf litter. These are the ones that will go to the top of an 18-inch piece of grass, and they will quest until something walks by, and then they kind of brush up against them and they hop on. Dog ticks are the same way, but Lone Star ticks will actively wander around. Lone Star ticks also have the very unique pattern of hanging together as larvae so that an entire cluster of larvae will climb onto you all at the same time. With dog ticks and deer ticks, we are not likely to be bitten by larvae. The larvae much prefer rodent hosts, but we can be bitten by the nymphs of the Lone Star and the deer tick. And in fact, the nymph of the deer tick is hands down the type of tick and life stage that is most likely to give you some sort of disease, because they are so tiny and their saliva is not as irritating as the Lone Star tick, so we don't notice them until after they've fed for more than 24 hours.
So you're saying that it's the deer tick nymphs?
Yeah, that's the one that's most likely to give you a disease, because the deer tick carries more diseases, so far as we know, than the Lone Star tick, even though the Lone Star tick is more prevalent. The larvae of the deer tick don't feed on us usually, but the larvae of the Lone Star tick do. But the good thing about larvae is that because they're the ones that have just hatched out of the eggs, they're typically not carrying disease. And so if a larval tick feeds on you, you are the first thing that they have fed on. The nymphs and the adults, so of all three ticks, can carry disease, but dog tick nymphs generally don't feed on us either.
Okay, so now, Lone Star ticks also carry Lyme disease and babesiosis?
No, only the deer tick carries Lyme disease and babesiosis, as far as we know. But the Lone Star tick can carry Ehrlichiosis. So deer tick, black-legged tick, I hope I said that right the first time, Lyme disease, babesiosis, anaplasmosis, and Borrelia myomotoi, which is a new one that's been cropping up here and there. One of my very good friends just had that, versus the Lone Star tick, which carries Ehrlichiosis, which is the main one we see around here, and dog ticks, Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
So tell us some of the symptoms of Ehrlichiosis and this new one you talked about. I know babesiosis is like malaria.
And that's a protozoal disease, so that's different. We've known about these particular diseases for quite a while. Unfortunately, all of them have very similar symptoms. You have a flu-like illness. You have aches and pains. You may have a fever. The rash that they always talk about associated with Lyme disease often does not occur. The rash that is associated with Lyme disease often does not occur in an individual. So the rash is not the be-all and the end-all. The new one that I mentioned was Borrelia myomotoi, which can be very, make someone very, very ill. Also, there's another bacterial disease that people should be aware of that does have a unique and weird rash, and that's Bartonella. Bartonella is a bacteria, and it presents with a rash that looks like stretch marks. So if you end up with some kind of weird-looking rash that looks like stretch marks, and you also have febrile symptoms, you feel like you have the flu, then talk to the doctor about the possibility, because Bartonella is something that co-infects a lot of times with Lyme disease. As we mentioned, Babesia is a protozoal disease, so that requires a different kind of medication than the bacterial diseases we mentioned. And I should also mention, while we're talking about diseases, that the Powassan virus or deer tick virus is associated with deer ticks, and that is unique in that it can infect, after the tick has bitten you, within about 15 minutes, compared to everything else, which takes at least 24 hours. So fortunately, the deer tick and Powassan viruses, which are closely related, are not terribly common, so that's a lucky thing. And as for the other diseases, it's important that you perform multiple tick checks during the course of a day, especially if you've been out in territory where you know there are plenty of ticks.
If you've just joined Sustainable East End, we're talking with Dr. Tamsin Ye of the Cornell Cooperative Extension about ticks. Now, treatment. You've mentioned some treatments and differentiating between them. Could you talk a little bit more about treatment? You know, let's say you've done a tick check and you've noticed a tick. You're not sure exactly what it is. What do you do?
Okay, so the first thing you should probably do, you definitely need to do, is you want to save the tick at you. Put it into a Ziploc bag, write the date on the bag, and put the bag in the freezer. So that way you can take it to your physician, and they can identify it for you, or you can bring it to Cornell Cooperative Extension, and we can also identify what kind of tick. So that's your first step. Second step is if you feel uncomfortable or it was identified as a deer tick and it was on you for more than 24 hours, you should go to your physician and they can possibly prescribe preventive antibiotics if they feel that it is warranted. By the way, I should mention too that the CDC has very good fact sheets on all these different diseases, and so you can go to the CDC and look up the individual diseases to find out about their symptoms, etc. Typically, physicians will give doxycycline as the drug of choice for the bacterially based infections. I'm not certain what they use for babesia. I probably have heard what they've used before, but I'm not a physician, so I don't want to, make a wrong statement on the drug that was used for that. They may have changed the amount that they give now and the duration of the treatment with doxycycline. I think that they have shortened the time frame that you take the medication, but there's a couple of things to remember. I believe that doxycycline causes extra sensitivity to the sun, so people should read their medication carefully. And the other thing is if they have gone through any kind of immunological testing to see if they have certain diseases, a standard tick panel does not cover Rocky Mountain spotted fever, as far as I remember. Then there's a very good site on the CDC's website that talks about the testing protocol for Lyme disease. But anyway, I just want to urge people, if they feel uncomfortable, if they feel like they've been bitten by a tick and they feel that they are ill, but the tests come back negative, make sure you keep going with that, because occasionally there are false negatives when somebody actually is ill. They're trying to perfect the immunological testing so that people don't slip through the cracks. But particularly for Lyme disease, it's a very strange disease in that it will change its outer surface protein coat, and the immunological tests are based on that protein. So if they encounter the disease organism that changed its coat, that can make you have a false negative. But that's all explained on the CDC website.
So, Dr. Ye, you deal with landscapes, and so I'd like to ask you about how can people protect their properties from ticks? Because this is an issue that has ecological implications as well. I mean, we don't want to destroy the environment while we protect ourselves from ticks.
That's very, very true. One thing people can do is to not overwater their properties, because that encourages both ticks and mosquitoes. Another thing they can do is they can practice good bird feeder hygiene. Birds are messy eaters. They will pull out seeds, and ones they don't like, they'll allow to drop to the ground. And, of course, what do seeds attract but rodents? And we know that rodents drive the deer tick population particularly. If they have wildlife trafficking through their yards, for example, you can see if deer typically do wander through the yards, you know that you're probably going to have more ticks in those areas. So if you can exclude the wildlife from, you know, traveling through your yard, that's a really good idea. If you can't exclude them altogether, what you can do is you can make sure that you find out where the ticks are in your yard so that you can either take cultural action by pruning, you know, long grasses back or branches or what have you, or trying to make sure it's less user-friendly for wildlife. So, in other words, you want to discourage particularly deer from trafficking through the yard. because they move the Lone Star ticks around.
Hmm.
Chipmunks also, the deer ticks really like to hang out where chipmunks hang out, so that's another thing to look for. The other thing I can suggest is there is a plant called a barberry, which is on the invasive plants list, but it's a very common landscape plant. The deer ticks, particular, love to hang out under barberries because the humidity is extremely high, and that high humidity allows the deer ticks to quest much more frequently and for longer periods of time. So that's a place that deer like to hang out as well. They love to hang out in barberry, and rodents also love to hang out. So if you've got barberry, maybe prune that severely so that you don't have that underlying humidity, or remove it altogether. Now, there is a way to check your property to see if you have ticks. You can buy a piece of flannel, white flannel or white corduroy, and you can staple that onto a stick or a dowel, or you can sew a pocket and just pass the dowel or the stick through it, and you can drag your property in areas where you feel you're picking up ticks. You walk about 10 paces, and then you turn the flag over, and you look at it, and pretty soon you'll see things moving.
Hmm.
So you can take a look at it and study it, and you can actually find out where your hot spots are for ticks on your property. The other thing is you want to be very aware of where rodents are hanging out. Mice, of course, are really good sources for ticks to feed on, and they like ground covers. Ticks also like ground covers. So you want to pay attention when you are out there scouting to your ground covers, and if it turns out that there are a lot of, say, Lone Star tick nymphs in the ground covers, that's probably because there are rodents in there. And you can actually mow your ground covers. They won't look very nice for a while, but that will cause the ticks and the rodents to disperse.
Now, many of us have pets. I have a cat who needs to go outside. I make sure that she can't get birds when she does, but she does go outside. I never seem to find ticks on her. I have used Frontline, but I'm worried about it. Yeah.
Right. The thing to do with your pets is you want to scout them frequently, and of course your pets will probably enjoy this because you can use that time to give them a little extra petting too, but you can check in hidden places like the armpits and underneath the back legs and up on the abdomen whenever they come in to make sure that they have not been exposed to any ticks. Cats don't get the tick-borne diseases as frequently as dogs do. Dogs get many of the same tick-borne diseases that we do. And if you happen to own a horse, horses also frequently get tick-borne diseases. So having some sort of preventative on the pet, especially if they have free range through tick territory, is a very, very good idea. And there are several options. There's a collar option, and there's other product options. But if they're outside frequently, especially if they're not on a lead or anything like that, it is good to have them protected in some way.
Now, just a final question. What about the life cycle of ticks? I mean, I used to feel like I could go out into the woods in the wintertime, but with climate change, we have warmer winters. Do we have to be afraid of ticks all year round?
If temperatures are above 40 degrees, yes, ticks will be questing. In the wintertime, it's going to be, most of the time, it's going to be adult ticks that are out questing. But we tend to have some very warm days during the winter, so you have to be very vigilant about that. The tick life cycle is that eggs are laid in the leaf litter, and that usually happens in the previous fall, and then they will hatch out, and sometimes the nymphs will also overwinter. So you have the life cycle of eggs, and they hatch into larvae. The larvae then molt and become nymphs, and at each stage, of course, there's a blood meal that's taken. Then the nymphs take a blood meal, and then they become adults. And the three types of ticks, their timing is a little bit different, but we have to worry about adult deer ticks from February to June for the most part, although you will encounter them a little earlier or a little later sometimes. And then if we're talking about the nips of the deer tick, they are from April until July. And then finally, we don't have to worry about the larvae, of course, because they generally feed on rodents. And then for the dog tick, we generally have to worry about them between the months of February to September. And we don't worry about the nymphs or the larvae for the dog tick. And then finally, for the Lone Star tick, we are likely to encounter the adults between March and September. And then the nymphs of the Lone Star tick are around for a very long time. They're around from March to November. And then finally, the larvae, which are what most people think are chiggers, are around from late May through October and occasionally into early November.
So basically, it's just December, January, February, where you don't have to worry too much.
For the most part. Oh, if you get a warm day in December or January, they will be out there. Not in quantity, but they will be out there. So you always want to check.
Well, Tamsin Ye, this has just been so interesting and informative. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Sustainable East End.
No problem. Hopefully their ticks will be so voracious all the time. But right now, we need to watch it.
This is Sustainable East End. We spoke with Dr. Tamsin Ye of the Cornell Cooperative Extension of Suffolk County about ticks, the diseases they carry, and how to protect against them. Dr. Ye works with the Pest Management Program at Cornell Cooperative Extension. That program is designed to phase out pesticide use on Suffolk County properties. More info is available at ccesuffolk.org. Sustainable East End is heard on the third Wednesday of every month. The programs are archived at sustainableeastend.blogspot.com. Sustainable East End is produced by Tony Ernst and yours truly, Francesca Rhiannon.